Welcome back to Listening to the Dead, Season 2. More crimes, more forensics, more revelations. This is Episode 4, Strangulation.
Hello and welcome back to Listening to the Dead. I'm John Watt, and as always, I'm lucky enough to be sharing this virtual crime scene with the queen of crime drama, Linda LaPlante, and former CSI, Kaz Sutherland. This week, our cause of death is strangulation. Strangulation is one of the causes of death that sadly divides the sexes, with women overwhelmingly more likely to be victims of this crime. And it's one of the reasons why, as we record this in early March 2021, the UK government has just announced plans to introduce a new law to make non-fatal strangulation an offence punishable by up to 5 years in jail.
Yeah, you know, it really is a terrifying crime, and it's often used by domestic abusers to control their partners. And because it doesn't leave any real kind of obvious marks to begin with, it's often difficult to bring charges. You know, they can say they have maybe bruises on their neck. And so somebody could have attempted strangulation and then gets away with it. It's not something that happens in a few seconds. It takes a long time to actually strangle someone to death. And you're very, very close to their face. You're leaning over them or right across them if they're on the ground, and your hands around their neck. And I think I've heard and read often, it is gives the killer pleasure to actually watch their victims dying. Somebody who kills in that way over and over again have established that they want to see them die.
Kaz, that's a good point, isn't it? Because by definition, with strangulation, perpetrator and victim are in close proximity. So does that make it easier to investigate?
Yeah, it does. Sometimes it makes it easier to investigate if it's a bit of a rope that's been cut and you have the piece still in the house somewhere and you can get the mechanical fit makes life easy, but that doesn't often happen. In scenes like that, I call the pathologist to them to see the body in situ, but also to see the ligature as well in situ. Because we obviously have to remove it. Sometimes it's necessary to remove it at the scene because you want to preserve it for best evidence. Other times we would remove it at the mortuary. But I think, particularly in strangulations, it's nice for a pathologist to see it in situ. And also there are occasions, obviously, where sexual assault may have taken place as well and you need sexual swabs. Yes, FMEs could do them, but I'd much prefer a pathologist to attend and do them in a murder investigation.
Yeah, well, that seems like an excellent time to welcome this week's expert, seasoned pathologist from Forensic Access, Brett Lockyer. Brett, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brett, how prevalent are cases of strangulation in your work today?
Well, they're not that common. We do get them. The most common form of homicide that we get is stabbing. And in women, I would imagine, well, apart from stabbing, the most common form of homicide in women is strangulation or neck compression. So we do get them. They're not extremely common. I would say in the course of a year, I would probably personally deal with about 4 or 5 cases of neck compression throughout the year. So, yeah, we don't get them that commonly, but they do occur.
And just to be clear, like neck compression, that is both strangulation with hands or with a rope or what you'd call a ligature, or does that include hanging as well?
That's right, yeah. So neck compression includes anything where the neck is being squashed. So most common form is hanging. Unfortunately, hanging is the most common form of suicide in the United Kingdom. Then you have manual strangulation, which is where someone applies their hands or arm around someone's neck. And then the third type is the ligature strangulation, which is similar to hanging in that it uses a ligature, but rather than being suspended, the ligature is being pulled tight.
Yeah. When do you attend the scene, Brett?
Well, it's actually, again, it's not that often that we get called to scenes. I think that the TV will often suggest that pathologists are called to every scene. In reality, that doesn't really happen that way. In the course of a year, I will do, say if I did 100 suspicious deaths, I would probably only attend the scene in about one or two of those cases. And there's a reason for that. Firstly, is obviously technology's moved on. So gone are the days where the pathologist would just rock up at the scene, not wearing any protective gear, which you often see in very old depictions of pathologists. So we don't really go to scenes in the middle of the night. We certainly don't go to scenes looking for a body in the woods. When we do go to a scene, it's often because there's a very good reason for that. And that is, as Kaz has said, is due to either there's something unusual about the scene, which when the body is moved, that the crime scene investigators are worried that that's going to be lost, or they will require urgent processing of samples such as sexual swabs. So we would be called to the scene then. But as I say, it's not that often that I go to scenes.
I hate to say it, but I can still remember the days when the pathologist used to turn up a cigarette in one hand and a glass of whiskey in the other in the 70s. That wasn't uncommon.
No, and of course, nowadays as well, the scenes are a lot more controlled than they were before. So my understanding as well is that crime scene investigators don't want unnecessary people at a scene with the risk of losing trace evidence. So in my opinion, I don't think it's always necessary that I am going to a scene in any case. There's a lot of photographs which are often taken. And in some police forces now, there's videos being done of scenes. So I can actually walk through a scene without actually going to the scene, which is very useful.
Yeah. So if we take this case of strangulation, are there instances where it's difficult for you to tell whether the cause of death is strangulation?
Yes, yeah. Strangulation is a bit of it can be quite a difficult cause of death to come to, especially if there's been other forms of injury caused. So, for example, someone who's been beaten up but has also had an element of strangulation, it's very difficult to actually know where that strangulation fits in. So the signs that we look for, such as markings around the neck, fractures to the voice box or the bone at the top of the neck called the hyoid bone, and some of these petechial hemorrhages, which are pinpoint hemorrhages, they only indicate there's someone that there has been pressure applied to the neck. They don't actually indicate that is the cause of death. What you do is that you would then come into looking at the scene, looking at what other findings you have, as well as all other tests, and then you would consider whether or not strangulation has been important. It can be quite straightforward. So if there's no other cause of death or there's no other form of assault, then it's quite straightforward. But when someone has been subjected to various forms of assault, it becomes more difficult.
That is so fascinating.
That's really interesting, Brett. If we get more granular on that and dig down, what sort of evidence are you looking for at the post-mortem that can tell you whether it's a case of strangulation with hands, with ligature, or a hanging?
Well, forensic pathologists are very obsessed with necks because the neck is the most significant part of the body to be examined. So what we'd look for in case of neck compression would be any markings on the neck itself. So if there are any bruises, if someone's been strangled with someone else's hand, so if someone has had their hands around someone's neck, then we look for discoid bruises, which are bruises caused by the fingertips, and that leaves an ovoid bruise. If someone's been strangled for a neck hold, so the victim has had their neck placed into the fold of someone else's arm, this is something that which was often used in America. I think officers in America were using this as a form of restraint, especially sleeper holds, whereby you apply pressure to the side of the neck without squashing the airway, but compressing the blood vessels, and that causes the perpetrator to then fall asleep or become unconscious. In that situation, you don't always see anything externally. And then in ligature strangulation and in hanging, obviously the most significant finding is that of a ligature. So we'd see that either as a straight line within across the neck in a ligature strangulation, or as a mark which then raises to a point because of the hanging, the suspension part. So externally, there's a lot to look for. The other thing, obviously, to look for, again, is any signs of any scratch marks or any damage to the fingernails of the victim. So in someone who may have had a ligature strangulation, you may see some scratch marks about around the ligature where the victim has tried to remove the ligature from the neck, and the fingernails may get damaged as a consequence of frantically trying to remove that from around the neck.
Okay, those are all external markings, Brett. What about internally? Is there anything you can look for there?
Yeah, so internally we do. So we have to start with a bloodless field. So the first thing we do is drain the neck of any blood, and we do that by doing the internal examination of the neck last in the post-mortem examination. So after the organs of the chest and the brain has been removed, there's several reasons why we do that. The most of those is to try and exclude the possibility of artifact. So what you try, what you're looking for is you're looking for true bruising within the neck. So once you reflect the skin, you're looking for bruises within the deep muscles of the neck. The next thing is that once you, if you do find lots of deep bruises, which does raise suspicion about neck compression, especially in those cases where there are no external markings, the next stage is to examine the larynx and the hyoid bone, which are, so the Adam's apple area is the larynx, and then above that there's a bone called the hyoid bone, which is quite high in the neck. We look at those to see if there's any injuries to those structures, and if there are, then again, that would support that there's been a crushing mechanism to the neck. So in neck holds or in ligature strangulation, and also in manual strangulation. It's really important as well. The reason why we have to do that under a bloodless field is that in cases where someone is found face down, you can artifactually get bleeding occurring in the neck. So there's been a study done in Canada, in fact, where they were looking at deceased patients and placing them in a face-down position for a period of time and then coming back and examining them, and they found that they did actually develop artifactual hemorrhages within the neck structures. So knowing that, and then knowing the position in which the deceased was found, we then approach those cases, obviously with a slight degree of caution. But if we have a fractured neck structures together with the bleeding, then you're kind of home and dry, as we say in forensic pathology. So we know then that the findings would support that there's been fatal neck compression applied.
Can I just ask on that, Brett, what about when it comes to somebody suffocating somebody with a pillow? Does that make life much harder for you?
Yeah, so certain forms of asphyxia, like suffocation, are quite difficult to actually prove because they can leave little in the way of marks, especially if you have someone who's been intoxicated. So someone may have plied someone else with alcohol or with drugs and then smothered them. And in fact, there's a case which is not so long ago, but it's been televised, is a series called Catching a Killer, whereby the assailant is believed to have drugged his elderly victim and then suffocated him with a pillow. So in those cases, it's extremely, you're more likely than not to not find anything. It's only in cases where the suffocation has been forceful. Again, it goes back to those representations on TV where you see dramas and someone's being suffocated with a pillow and they're fighting and they're really pushing hard. In those cases, yes, you are likely to find injuries to the mouth. But in most cases where someone is sedated or drugged and then suffocated, you're unlikely to find findings. But as a forensic pathologist, we know what we were looking for, but they're very subtle changes.
Kaz, we started this by talking about the changing in the law recently to allow the prosecution of attempted strangulation now. How often are you finding people losing their temper? Is it a heat of the moment thing?
Generally, yes, it was. I sort of found it was loss of temper. I can't think of
anything where I dealt, you know, where something was premeditated and a rope was used. There may well have been, but generally, if it was premeditated, I found it was a knife, a gun, something like that. But I mean, I don't know from Brett's point of view, but generally it is loss of temper. And you may not just get the strangulation, you may also get a beating, and then the strangulation takes place. I had one case where the wife was wearing a dressing gown, and he having a big row with her, and there was a struggle, and then he just lost it and pulled the cord from the dressing gown put her on the floor, knelt on her back and strangled her.
Yeah, the domestic cases often do use, especially if there's a ligature involved, it is often a ligature of a household nature. I'm the same in that I've had cases where there has been items of clothing used, but also electrical items have been used as well. So flexes from hair straighteners were one case that I was involved in. Another case was the cord from an electric fan was used as a ligature. So often it's items that they have very nearby them, as you say, that would also support that impulsive act.
Yeah, interesting. We had one like that where a guy had gone round to see this lady, and he'd taken his dog with him, and he'd used the dog lead, and it was a chain dog lead, and you could see the chain marks actually on the neck. But another slight complication with that was that they thought they saw some numbers, or what appeared to be numbers, and somebody said, for example, it was 1, 2, 3. But that created a chain event of people who look at it, they would say, can you see the numbers 1, 2, 3? And people would go, yeah. But if you went to somebody and said, tell me what numbers you can see, you'd get a string of different numbers. And of course, that could cause you problems later on down the road, because everybody's saying, oh, it's definitely that. And you don't find anything with 1, 2, 3 on it. It causes you problems.
No, that's quite a good point, because the aspect of bias really is important, because I often will do that in my cases. So the police may come to me with a suggestion that, someone's a certain footwear has been used. And then what you do is you look at the injuries and you look at them and you try to see whether there are features within that injury which would support that footwear. It's better actually to take a step back and then say to yourself, right, if I wasn't told this, would I be looking at this injury and say this? And very often that helps me, and it has helped a lot, because again, the police get very excited about injury patterns. And as you say, if you make the injury fit what you think has been used, then you're not doing a good job. You have to be, I don't like to be told, for example, what type of weapon has been used. I like to come up with that suggestion at the end of the post-mortem, rather than being led through the post-mortem to make the injuries fit that weapon. So, yes, I actually insist that I'm not informed of what weapons may have been used in a case.
Yeah, I agree. We used to, if they had a knife at the scene, they said, oh, should we take it and show the pathologist? And no, we'll take it, but we'll keep it to one side till the end of the post-mortem. And a similar one where it created a chain of events, unfortunately for a pathologist, where somebody said that they saw somebody walking away with a big wooden pole in the hand, and the guy had stomach injuries. But what it actually turned out at the end of the day, cut a long story short, he flung himself out a window and hit a low wall and bounced off it.
Yeah.
And of course, the pathologist, because it had been led, went, said, yeah, well, that's possible, which created problems, you know, looking for who was this person with the pole, when it wasn't at the end of the day.
And the same things is true of ligatures as well, because obviously ligatures can often have patterns on them. For example, especially in hanging, it's very important for the pathologist to see the ligature, because what you're trying to do is you're not trying to establish the cause of death in those cases necessarily, because the cause of death can be very obvious that it's from hanging. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to ensure that it is a hanging, and it's not a strangulation made to look like a hanging. So therefore, it's really important to see the ligature. If the ligature hasn't come with the deceased, then it's important again for the pathologist to insist that the ligature does come, and that the pathologist can compare the ligature mark on the neck with that of the ligature. So, for example, cases where a blue towing rope has been used as the ligature, that will leave a quite a characteristic mark on the neck. And I've had cases in the past as well where people have hanged themselves with those canvas type bouts, you know, that can also leave this impression on the neck. So it's important that the pathologist does see the ligature at some point. It's not so much being misled in a ligature strangulation, but it's important that the pathologist does see the ligature and compare that with the mark.
What can the ligature itself tell you?
So if there's been a ligature strangulation, very often the ligature will come with the deceased. And it's really important for the pathologist to examine the ligature and see how the ligature has been wrapped around the neck, but then also to examine the type of knot which may have been used. So again, in hangings, the deceased will often use a simple knot or a slip knot. But in ligature strangulation, a slip knot, which is, I mean, I don't know how you do a slip knot, but I know that they're quite complicated. I don't think that the perpetrator would have time to form a slip knot. So the majority of the times they're quite simple knots. But the knot itself is very important because very often that will contain DNA from the person who's tied the knot. So what we will do in the post-mortem is not to disturb that knot. So we will try and cut the ligature away from the knot itself, which not only preserves the type of knot which has been formed, but then also would preserve any DNA which has been caught up in that knot, such as skin cells from the person who's tied the knot. But you may sometimes get hairs and things like that also caught up in the knot.
Sometimes you knew somebody had been strangled, the pathologist say it's strangulation and you have marks, but you didn't have the weapon or what was ever used. But we could tape the neck and the area for fibres. Good chance that whoever's done it is probably going to get rid of it. But people who tape things to a scene, if they have gone to the scene like that or something of theirs, may well put it in their pocket. And what they forget is that you then examine their pockets and you find fibres that are a perfect match to the fibres, particularly if it's a woolen fibre. If it's rope fibres, then I think I'm not a fibre expert, but I think rope fibres tend to be rope fibres, but different types of rope.
And the other thing, of course, as well, at the post-mortem is, and I know that some crime scene investigators would do it at the scene, but is to take scrapings or fingernail clippings, because they will also contain a lot of information in regards to the perpetrator, especially if the victim has made attempts to try and scratch that person to try and get them off them.
How long does it take to strangle someone? And is it different whether you're strangling them with hands, with forearm, with ligature?
It's not an easy task to strangle someone. And one of the questions that I will often get asked in Crown Court is, how long does it take to strangle someone? And that's actually quite a difficult question to answer. The only thing we can say is that the person who is causing that neck compression would know that they are doing it, because you don't just drop dead from a strangulation. So someone just grabbing you around the neck doesn't result in you just dropping dead there and then. There has been reports in the past that may be important, but we actually know now that no, that doesn't occur. So someone who's causing neck compression would have to apply that pressure for a significant amount of time. And otherwise, we're talking minutes rather than just seconds to cause someone's death. And one of the ways to think about that is it's estimated around 3 minutes of total starvation of the brain of oxygen or blood results in irreversible brain damage. And that's probably a good way to look at it, because, yeah, it's certainly not an instantaneous death.
Well, that raises the question of what actually kills the person. It seems kind of obvious that it's the oxygen, but is it really a lack of oxygen that kills you?
No, I mean, again, it's one of those things that it can be made rather simplistic by people who don't quite understand the mechanisms involved. So strangulation itself doesn't just result in, say, for example, squashing the airway so then someone can't breathe. It will often be a combination. So the neck has a lot of structures in it which are important. So you've got blood vessels there which are taking blood to the brain and bringing blood back to the heart. Then you've also got a lot of structures in regards to your airway. So you have your larynx, and then you have the windpipe, and then you have the tongue. So if you're applying pressure to the neck, you're not only squashing the airway as such, but you're also compressing those blood vessels, which are taking blood to the brain. The blood vessels taking blood to the brain, they can be squashed quite easily in that they don't require very much pressure, especially the veins. The veins collapse relatively quickly. Then your arteries, they require a bit more resistance. And then the most resistance is actually offered by the airway. So in ligature strangulation or in hanging, what can happen is that the ligature can push against the voice box and cause the tongue to then compress at the back of the neck. And then that stops someone from breathing because they can't bypass that blockage. But it's a combination of things. And we can't really say, oh, yes, it's the airway that's been squashed that's caused the death. In fact, it's probably more complex than that and involves all forms of mechanisms which cause death and strangulation rather than just one.
Brett, I know we're kind of like thinking mostly of people who become deceased, but what about people who survive or are in a coma in hospital? I used to find that the SIO would say, well, we'll get the FME to go to the hospital, or we'll get the doctor there to look at them and make the statement for us. Personally, my belief is, well, the experts in strangulation are pathologists. So even if the person's alive, let's get the pathologist, because they're the ones who will stand up in court and, you know their expertise around that strangulation is much better. Do you actually get called to many?
Yeah. So again, it's one of those things that I often get annoyed with the TV, because again, the TV always portrays the pathologist as being involved in just death, and that isn't the case. We're actually involved in living cases as well. And so you're absolutely right. If I don't see strangulation that often in my practice, then you can guarantee that a hospital doctor sees even less. So asking, you need an expert really to go in and assess those cases. For example, you wouldn't go and see a gastroenterologist if you had a problem with your toe. So the best thing to do is go to the expert who deals with those things all the time. And yes, I do both work in both the living and the deceased. Which kind of contravenes what the popular belief of a forensic pathologist is that we're rooting around in the woods in the middle of the night and we only deal with dead people. That isn't true in reality.
Oh, your glamorous image. You've ruined it for us.
Brett, could you tell me, are there any strangulation cases that are especially memorable to you?
Yeah, I've had one which was memorable, but not memorable because of necessarily the case, but memorable because of my involvement in the case. I was involved in a case in several steps. So again, we don't just do the post-mortem and then that's it, and then we turn up at Crown Court and we give our evidence. That isn't usually what happens. What will happen is that I will do the post-mortem. I'm then asked to produce a report. I produce my report, and then out of that report, the police will then come back to me with more questions. And one case that I was involved in, one of the questions was, one of the suggestions was that the victim died during a sexual act, and it was a sexual act that resulted in the death. And as I said before, that doesn't happen in reality. You don't just die just because someone has their arm around your neck for seconds. Strangulation and any neck compression will go through stages. So the first thing is that the pressure's applied, the blood's reduced to the brain, and then that causes someone to become unconscious. If you release that pressure, they'll regain consciousness and they'll be fine. There'll be no problem. But if you keep that pressure applied, that's when you'll have the problem, because then it results in the irreversible brain damage. It then results in damage to the parts of the brain which regulate breathing and heart rate, and then that will cause the death. So that case for me was quite memorable because it was quite interesting, because it was comparing what the assailant suggested had happened to what you were finding at the post-mortem. And again, that's kind of the basis of most of forensic pathology, is that we're presented with a story. Does the story fit what we're seeing? And if it doesn't, then that's when you start raising concerns.
Interesting, sort of picking up that on a strangulation one I had, a stranger one in Kent many years ago, and the victim, she was found in the living room, and a pair of tights were around her neck, but they went from the front to the back to the front, and there was semen found on her breast and in her mouth, and the impression was that he had controlled her by using the tights and then strangled her. But we knew that the only defence that the suspect had come up with was, it wasn't me. Yes, I was having an affair with her. I was there. It must have been the boyfriend because he found out about it. What we did was we spoke to a gastroenterologist, and she basically said that ingested semen would actually be treated like food by the gastrointestinal tract, and anything that's placed in the mouth, and you're going to swallow it or spit it out. And if it goes to the back of the mouth and you've been strangled, it can't be spat. It can't go down. And the forensic expert who did the stomach contents didn't find any traces of semen. Therefore, it was reasonable to conclude that the suspect was there at the scene around about the time of her death. And he had an alibi, totally different. But that destroyed that, and that basically was what helped convict him.
That was a fascinating one. I mean, another case I seem to remember that you have insight into, a unique insight, Cass, is the famous case of the Suffolk Strangler, or the Ipswich serial murder.
Yeah. Only in that he used to run the pub up the road from where I lived. he was managing it. It used to be the White Horse, and it became the Penny Farthing.
That was Steve Wright, the Ipswich murderer. One of the rare occasions, I think, when a UK serial killer has used strangulation as their MO. That's all we've got time for, sadly. Brett, thank you so much for joining us. Another fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kaz and Linda, as always. Next week, we've got our mid-season break, so we'll be back in 2 weeks on the 31st of March for Cause of Death, Poisoning.
It's kind of really advanced from your old arsenic. And all that aha, I could smell the almonds. It's moved on from that. Somebody touching a doorknob with this stuff on and they're dying. Quite terrifying. So in actual fact, poisoning has advanced.
Until then, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening now. And check out Linda's website, lindalaplante.com, for more info on the show and the guests. See you in a couple of weeks. Listening to the Dead is made in collaboration with Bonnier Books UK.
CrimeCon, the world's number one true crime event. Get inside the mind of serial killers and psychopaths. Learn from leading criminologists. Hear from the families and survivors. Meet your favorite true crime podcasters. Immerse yourself in forensic evidence and delve deeper into unsolved crimes. CrimeCon is the ultimate true crime weekend, partnered by Crime and Investigation. I will be there, as will Cass, so come and join us. Quote Bonnier, that is Bonnier, to claim a 10% discount. Limited tickets are on sale now. For more information, visit crimecon.co.uk. See you there.